Hi, you're listening to Go See a Show, the Off-Off-Broadway podcast. By way of an introduction, I'll give the quick setup of the show featured on today's episode, The Kindling Theater Company's Take Me Back, currently playing at Walker Space in Manhattan. Bill has just been released from a four-year stint in federal prison, and he's now living with his mom in Muskogee, Oklahoma. That's all you really need to know before listening to this conversation with some of the brilliant minds behind this production, which will fill in a lot of the blanks and hopefully pique your interest into going to see this show, because it's a good one. And now, here are playwright Emily Schwend, director Jay Stull, and actress Boo Killebrew of Take Me Back. Take a listen.
Great. So I like to start with everybody's name on the mic. So we'll just go around. We'll start with the playwright.
Emily Schwend.
Hi, I'm Jay Stull.
Hi, I'm Boo Killebrew.
And the play is Take Me Back. Emily wrote, Jay directed, Boo is in the show. And I start with the typical, what is your elevator pitch for the show, usually, with the podcast? So if you had to tell someone, hey, we're doing the show, you should come see it, here's why, what do you say?
I guess I would say it's an intimate, specific, very dark comedy that if you are interested in going to a part of the country you might not have visited before and seeing people and how they might really live, it'd be a good play to see.
I guess I would say, you know, is it possible to be good as a person in places where there is no opportunity for improvement or employment? Yeah, that would be my elevator pitch.
And taking from those two things, like it definitely marries the personal and the social, which I think is really, really cool and very interesting and very current. And but you talked about this being a place in the country that most of us don't know. However, I believe you're Boo. You're from Mississippi. Mm-hmm. Was that what I read? Mm-hmm. And so you have some connection at least to the South, which is of course not Oklahoma, in Muskogee, Oklahoma, where this is set, but at the very least a little bit more geographically close than New York City.
Yeah, and I'm from Texas, so I'm not
speaking
out of my...
Where does that come from? So why Muskogee?
Well, I dated a fellow from Oklahoma for a couple years. That's basically the answer I'll give. I really got introduced... Like, I'm from Texas, northern Texas, so which is basically just across the street from Oklahoma. And when I was visit, we were long distance. He was in Oklahoma, I was in New York, and so I went to Oklahoma quite a bit, and... yeah, and it just kind of stuck with me, that kind of the way that people talk there, the way that culture kind of moves there. Everything's a little bit slower. Everything's a little bit under the surface. It reminded me a lot of when I was growing up in Texas, which I don't write about a lot. I don't write about Texas pretty much ever in my writing. I guess it's too hard, or I feel like I have 50 members of my family from Texas and don't want them to see it. So, but I really fell in love with it in a way that I just had to revisit a few years afterwards.
And that... not to analyze you, but you can get kind of close being in Texas or being in Oklahoma, setting the show in Oklahoma. You could sort of get, I don't know. I was, what I'm really interested in the personal aspect of this is how much, and I mentioned this to Jay before I turned on the mic, how uncomfortably close it is to my own experience.
Interesting.
And uncomfortable in the best sort of way.
Where are you from?
I'm from upstate New York.
Okay.
So also just a little bit, you know, quieter, a little, everything under
the
surface.
So is James, our lead, is from upstate New York, and he said the same thing, that he was like, I know I'm from upstate New York, but I feel a kinship with this play.
There's a reality, an American reality, that I think many of us in New York City can often forget.
Yeah.
No matter what our economic level in New York City, this is a totally different world than most of what the country is. So is that part of what, like, y'all are doing to bring this... I don't know. I guess my question is, like, why this play in New York?
I think I guess I'll answer this in part because
I just wrote it. So I wrote it because I wanted to. I didn't think about any of that.
I really like these ideas. I mean, I'm from a place that's not New York. I'm from Virginia, and I was always reminded that there's a sense that we're all from different parts of the country that are outside of New York. And yet we're speaking for a broad swath that might not be terribly descriptive. And we're always very cautious, I think, to avoid caricature and overgeneralization. But one of the things that's true about all of us is that we have a connection, either our own personal connection or through our families, in narratives that deal with people whose opportunities have a limit. And you can be, I mean, this is a controversial thing, but as artists, we're oftentimes poor in New York, but we aspire towards things, and there's a lot of narratives to help justify our existence. There are a lot of people who are poor in New York who have a cap on what they can achieve because of systematic limitations, and there's a lot of that in the country. And I thought, I'm just interested in that, because I'm interested in drama that comes out of systematic inequality, but is also driven in this place so beautifully by what we might consider to be maybe a flawed character.
Flawed character, or also, I would submit, just choices. Mm-hmm. And the character is, of Bill is young-ish, so you could possibly maybe chalk it up to youthful indiscretion, his first sin of the play that we are introduced to. So there are choices, and you know there are some people who will make. I think we will all make terrible choices. Is kind of what I'm getting at. At some point, all of us make terrible choices.
Have made.
Oh, and probably will again. Yeah. I mean, I would never discount myself from that. But because some of us pay for it in a different way, mm-hmm. and it's like, what is the nature of the transgression, and who caught it? I guess is a. So you talked to Jay. You talked a little bit about goodness. I think there's also bad decisions that. I'm so sorry. I forgot your character name.
Julie.
Mm-hmm. It certainly seems like she's hinting at I made bad decisions, mm-hmm. but she doesn't have to pay for them in the way that Bill did.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I think she's still paying for them. You know, she didn't have to go to prison for 4 years, but I would argue that her life in her house in Garland with her new husband is a prison of sorts, you know? Mm-hmm. And so I don't know, I feel like especially in these parts of the country, like and in Mississippi too, there aren't many choices, you know? It's sort of like, do this, like for women, get married, have children, do this, you know, or go to a job at a bank, go to a job at Best Buy or Walmart, or be a criminal. I mean, that's in Mississippi. I know that's the way my friends are going. Or get out. Mm-hmm. You know, which is what I did. But yeah, I think that your choices are limited, and that is a reality that a lot of people here in New York really don't see. And I forget about it. You know, I'm from Mississippi, and every time I go home, I'm like, oh God. You know, it feels like it's just a thing I take for granted, that I do have freedom in a way here, you know. But I'm poor and I'm struggling and all that stuff, but I'm not stuck in any sort of prison by any means. You know?
I just to play devil's advocate, because I'm interested in this idea, like, is there no way out? Is there a cap? Or is it just the appearance of a cap that we can't see beyond? There's moments in the play, and the Sue, mm-hmm. is the mother's name, where Sue willfully ignores and denies a clear and present reality, mm-hmm. She actually denies one of them through the entire play. She just willfully ignores a health problem. So is it that there are no opportunities, or is it that we don't, that something systemic is telling us or forcing us to look away from it?
I'll speak to that one, because Sue's health issues came from a very personal place for me, and I'm sure he'll listen to this, but my dad was pre-diabetic for a couple years, did nothing to change that, and is now diabetic. And now he's changed his diet, now he's working on it, but it took him to get to that point. And he's certainly not somebody who doesn't have opportunities. He's doing fine, he's retired, you know, he's not in Sue's position at all, and never has been, but that still happened to him. And I that's almost a cultural thing in a way, or a character thing in a way, like a willful denial of taking responsibility for something or whatever the reason is why people get themselves into health issues that they can prevent. And I had a lot of anger about that, and that's where this character came from, where it's very frustrating to deal with that. So for me, that was less commentary on place or on position in life than just like people do this to themselves. Anyone does.
And I just find that really interesting because I think we all do.
Yeah.
In some way. I mean, totally. We all ignore something.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's so interesting because I'm speaking from maybe a broader social, I'm always interested in kind of like the politics of the world in which this play exists. And one of the things I remember saying in rehearsal as a form of contextualizing this play is that Sue is of a generation where she can trust her food. Mm. And yet she's now living in a world where even the things that advertise themselves as being healthier or good for her are actually just made of sugar and water.
Drink the orange juice. Yeah.
It's inconceivable to Sue that her orange juice wouldn't be orange juice. And yet Bill is somehow less naive than his mother because he was raised in a world where there's danger around every corner and where the trust of the social fabric has frayed enough that you worry that it will tear or that it has torn. And Sue is not of that generation. And it's a really touching, for me, juxtaposition to see somebody who doesn't understand that the very things that she's consuming, that the food companies that provide her with her sustenance would be more interested in how addictive the food is for her and their bottom line than how nutritious it is and whether it's healthy. And so that was always I think the personal story of diabetes is so interesting because it creates such tension with Bill. And then to situate it in a world where tons of people are existing on an old trust that doesn't exist anymore.
Yeah, my grandmother was like that. I remember she was a big woman, like 300 pounds, till the day she passed. And she used to, you know, she would order KFC for us, but then she would always get fat-free cheese, you know, and fat-free mayo. And I'm like, just eat regular cheese and like don't eat KFC. Like that was kind of like, when I grew up, I was like, that was the problem. Like that it's this idea of like, I'm doing these things that are good for me because it's fat free. And because, but so then this other stuff, it's real chicken, doesn't matter. And it's this kind of ignorance to it, and not ignorance in a way that's like, it's like, of course she didn't know. Cause she grew up when like chicken was okay.
Yeah.
And
chicken was chicken.
And it wasn't this weird thing. And like, of course she didn't. She's Italian. So she cooked all of her food. So for her, like ordering food wasn't a thing she ever did. She didn't grow up learning how to order food.
Yeah.
So it was just like ordering food is just like, of course it's food, right. You know, even pasta. Like she used to love going to like, Olive Garden, and it's like Olive Garden's horrible and everything right. They make is full of butter. And she's like, no, it's Italian. Italian food's good for you. Oh yeah.
And so much of the play turns on a community that doesn't support each other. The plot of the play depends upon a neighbor who is so alienated that they would make a certain choice that drives the plot and puts Bill in a terrible position. And one thinks about how communities, both locally in Muskogee and then also nationally, no longer exist for the benefit of common good, but exist for both individual good and then individual spite.
Yeah, and you know, what's good for me and my lawn and how my property appears. And
and if you fuck with me, that I'm sorry, can I say that? If
of
you
course
screw
you can.
With me.
This podcast are not regulated by the FCC.
Oh, okay.
Yet.
If you fuck with me, what will I do? You know, how petty can our initial conflict be?
Yeah.
And then how out of control and chaotic can the consequences
become?
What
do I have control over? What is my property? Mm-hmm. You know, like this is mine. I'll do everything I can to defend it because I'm like holding on with white knuckled fear here. You know, like,
and there's something very American about that, which I actually like, is that we talk about that being the fraying of a social construct, but it really is kind of the basis of this country.
That's
when
right.
we talk about frontier mentality,
yeah.
and we also talk about areas of the country where, in New York, when we tend to have a fairly progressive large state problems, we don't understand people who are from states that attempt to minimize that social network.
Mm-hmm.
I have two questions before we close out. One is, what was the rehearsal process like for you two? Right now, I'm assuming you were in the room as well, mm-hmm. Emily. What was the rehearsal process like to put this together something that is not immediately, this is not a dialect we all hear on a regular basis or even can steal from, you know, British movies or anything. Like, really, you don't, this was Oklahoma. Like, mm-hmm. we were hearing an Oklahoma accent. It was a supernatural form of acting. And that's not, I feel like that's not necessarily en vogue these days. I don't see a whole lot of it. And it was done to beautiful effect. So how'd you pull this up?
Well, the play is written like that. I mean, the play is, Emily's written it in a very naturalistic way, and the dialect is written in, I mean, the rhythms, mm-hmm. you know, and the space the script gives, you know, for naturalistic behavior. And so for me, that was really informative. And then I'll let Jay finish, but it was, he set up a room that gave tons of space. The play gives tons of space. Jay gave tons of space, and we give lots of space to each other. And I agree, I like the naturalistic acting type stuff. I haven't done it in so long, and I haven't seen it in so long. And I was like, oh wow, like a chair is a chair, and a Hershey kiss is a Hershey kiss, and I get to talk like I would normally talk. And it was tricky, because at some point I was like, well, do I seem lazy? Do I seem like not into it? But it, Jay constantly encouraged us to like feel the heat, you know, it sounds, I don't mean to, but like to, and to hear the sounds of the Oklahoma landscape. And I mean, there was a lot of gentleness and freedom in the rehearsal room, which I don't know, it made it, it wasn't tricky.
Yeah, this is the major thing that what you're saying is the great acting in the play. I mean, the play, the text is written in a way that is self-executing.
That's right.
But I will say, and what I've said to the actors a lot, is that it has, it's fragile. It has a tissue-thin quality. And I think it's, I really love naturalism, and I'm, obviously because of this play, I'm in a lot of discussions with friends of mine about why I love naturalism. They love this play, but it's always, you're right, it's not in vogue. And I think, and I don't quite have an answer to why I like it, but I think it says more about class than, in America today, than a lot of other theater that's happening. But that's a very, I don't know if I'm going to go to mm-hmm. go to the bank on that. But I think one of the things that I thought was really tricky, just as actors, is you want to make a show, and there's a lot of air, and there's a lot of space, and Emily's play exists in those spaces, and it's just so tricky for people to be told to actually take time when they've been taught not to, mm-hmm. or when it's just, it's like a, you know, wrong to do. But so much of Sue's boredom at home, and so much of the air that's taken in between what people say, paints the landscape of why it's so hard for her to let him go at the end, because it's desolate and it's a desert and there is no one, and the only people you have are your family, even if they fuck up. So it needs that air, and the actors were also self-executing, amazing people who understood this in the fiber of their being, so I had a very easy job.
Congrats on a really super great play. I said I had two more questions, and I'm kind of scared to ask this one, but I'm going to ask it anyway. And of course, without giving away anything, no spoilers, do you know what happens after this? And I would ask like that of everyone, because I was hoping for an ending that I didn't get, but that I also couldn't get given where the play ended. So do you know what happens after this?
I have my thoughts about what happens to Bill. I know what happens to Sue because there's another play I wrote about Randall. There's another play that's about Randall, who is Bill's brother. And so I know where Sue ends up. I know her deal, even though she's not in that one. I don't know what happens to Bill. I think that this is this play, these like 2 days that we see, essentially, maybe even 24 hours. I'm not sure what the chronology exactly is, but a day and a night and a morning. I think these are the most meaningful days of his life. And these are like the, if you look at life, I sometimes look at life in terms of like chapters of your life. I look at my life that way. And I feel like for him, there was like this first chapter, then this play, the events happened, and then he has his second chapter. And I hope for the best for him, I do. I don't know where he exactly ends up, but I kind of feel like he's different after this play. Mm-hmm. And for the better, hopefully, because he has to be.
I definitely agree. Like, I like that idea of this mm-hmm. being the turning of a page.
Mm-hmm. So that's how I feel like people leave this play sometimes and they feel, they're like, oh, it's sad or it's a bummer. But I kind of feel like we watched him grow up. Mm-hmm. And that's, it was late. It was mm-hmm. belated. He's like, you know, it was a very belated bloomer in a way, but we got to see that happen. And I don't leave feeling like, or I didn't write this and think of Bill as like this failure at the end. I actually was like, hopefully he can find some place where he can exist to get his shit together. Jay says a lot, well, you can say it, about how he can't exist in a certain society. Maybe he'll find one that he can exist in.
Yeah, I have such hope for Bill at the end. I mean, Bill is such a liminal character from the very beginning. I mean, he's criminal, which makes him liminal, especially in this country. Although common, increasingly common. And he's just a square peg in a round hole. And one of the things that happens in this play is this is the moment where he understands that it's not, that it may not be something that is inherent to his character. It may be something that is inherent to the incompatibility of his mm-hmm. person with where he's from.
Mm-hmm.
And I think any of us who are artists know that, and any of us who are sexual minorities or gender minorities or racial minorities or ethnic minorities recognize otherness. And what's so brilliant about this play is that Emily situates otherness in a straight white male who is criminal. And somehow I find myself sympathizing with him and hoping that he finds the world where he fits, I guess.
Beautiful thoughts at the end of a beautiful play. Mm-hmm. Thank you all very, very much. This is a really cool show. So thanks a lot.
Thanks.
Appreciate it.
Thanks.
Thank you, Emily, Jay, and Boo for hanging out after the show for that great conversation. You can and should go see Take Me Back at Walker Space, 46 Walker Street in Manhattan. There are just 3 more performances from the posting of this episode, so don't delay. Tonight, Thursday, March 20th at 8 p.m. Tomorrow, Friday, March 21st at 8 p.m. and Saturday, March 22nd, also at 8 p.m. Head over to smarttix.com and search Take Me Back for tickets. There's also an easy, clickable link in the blog post for this episode on GoSeeAShowPodcast.com. Thanks to you for listening to the podcast. If you dig it, give it a like on Facebook, facebook.com/GoSeeAShow. Follow at GoSeeAShow on Twitter and rate and or comment on the show's iTunes page. Go See a Show is supported by the 133rd Street Arts Center, a unique performance space in Harlem featuring a 70-seat black box theater, a flexible mixed-use lab space, lighting, prop, and costume rental, and more. The spaces are available for rent for performances or rehearsals at some of the most reasonable rates on the Isle of Manhattan. So, if your company or project is looking for space, get in touch with me. You can contact me with questions about the 133rd Street Arts Center, along with any comments, suggestions, praise, or complaints by email. Robbie, R-O-B-B-Y, at GoSeeAShowPodcast.com. Until next time, go see a show.
Great.
Thanks, dude.
Thank you.
That was a cool conversation.
Yeah. That was really cool.